Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us today. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. It's John Walton on the Caps Radio Network.
It's Hornquist that'll start with a puck in Pittsburgh. A quick sigh and then a head up ice. A tag on the right wing to Crosby. A poke check away and now the counter. Here come the Caps. Kuznetsov gets loose. Evgeny coming down the middle. A shot and it comes in over. He scores! Evgeny Kuznetsov wins it for Washington! It's off to the third round! The Demons have been exercised! Good morning! Good afternoon! And good night, Pittsburgh! We're going to Tampa Bay! The Capitals have done it!
I get paid for the game. I'm getting more games.
No, I'm just kidding.
that's just a joke.
John's a very good play-by-play guy. That's a really good call, too.
All right. Keith Smith tomorrow, RealGM.com, and the host of the NBA Front Office Show podcast. Again, that's coming up a little bit later in our show today. Let's see. And then tomorrow, Mark Narducci, Philadelphia Inquirer, is going to be with us. No show on Thursday. Oh, look, put your hands back on the wheel. Stop clapping. I mean, really, no show Thursday, okay? And Greg Wilshinsky, the ESPN NHL writer, will be joining us. And then the Fresh Prince of South Windsor will be on with us. If you've never been to South Windsor, you don't know what a hopping place that is.
My life is incomplete until I get there.
No, I wouldn't say that. All right. All right. Well, last week, Neil Coulong couldn't be with us. There was a lot of depression. But I got some really good Steelers info from the janitor and the suit. So kind of filled the void. Let's bring Neil in. Neil, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Another shark in the tank? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm just telling you, Neil, the pressure's on. This guy was good. He was over there. he was taking care of the floors and the whole thing, and he's telling me all about Roethlisberger. He knew it all.
He probably makes more than I do.
That's kind of sad, but true. let's get to the drama queen. How's he doing today?
I don't know. We haven't quite heard from him yet. The only thing I heard, in fact, was from a leak out of the Steelers organization that said that Roethlisberger wasn't going to go to the Penguins game the other night, but they offered the tickets to Mason Rudolph. He said he's going to go to every home game for the next 5 years now. So
already endearing himself to the populace, is he? Yeah.
I don't know what direction he needs to go with all of that, but at the same time, it's kind of, for my money, what did you really expect him to say? One, it's such a Roethlisberger comment. It's very kind of passive-aggressive, and it's also pretty much on the nose. I mean, that's really kind of the mentality you think that he would have. You understand where he's coming from, you know, but it, really the truth is, and I'm sure that the organization would tell him this in on simple terms, that we didn't draft him to take over next year, okay? Either way, though, you have to understand our position. We can't get stuck with, you know, Josh Dobbs or a free agent as our starter if anything should happen. So really, this is nothing more than insurance. And it's also, you know, from a value perspective, Mason Rudolph, to me, he's an excellent quarterback. I thought he did enough to merit the first-round looks that teams were giving to him, and I didn't think he'd fall past the second. I think it was really more just because so many quarterbacks went in the first round, it was a bit harder for you know, the market to say somebody is going to take him in the second round. It's about need versus availability. It's not just about talent. And for him to have fallen to the third – I think for the Steelers' sake, that's obviously the biggest value pick, and I think it's the most valuable pick that they have in the draft in terms of what they spent for it. So Roethlisberger wants to look at it very specifically, and that's fine because that's his job. But bigger picture, the team did the right thing. They made a smart move, and it really shouldn't threaten anybody at this point.
Except Landry Jones.
For Landry Jones. He's only got 1 year left on his deal anyway. So kind of, you know, it puts him on notice more than anybody else. Maybe that's who Ben's sticking up for.
I doubt it because I think he knows Landry Jones can't take his job down the road. I mean,
yeah, look, that's an excellent point. he absolutely cannot.
Look, you look at – you can understand a guy like him saying, well, look, you're not here to take my job. I've got my job. I understand that part, but don't you have to have a little more security in yourself than that?
because I would hope you are the man in that.
You know, you may not be the most popular guy in the city because he's not. All right, but on that team, no you, no go.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely nothing that Roethlisberger could have seen to this point to make him think otherwise. I also think. The veteran protecting his turf, maybe a knee-jerk reaction, or maybe even to the point where, you know, he's saying something to kind of drum up ratings on his radio show each week. But there really isn't anything with this move that I think Ben needs to be threatened by, save this one simple fact. I don't think it was an accident. He said 3 to 5 years that he wants to continue playing. He's only got 2 years left on his contract. To me, more than anything, when I heard that, my initial thought was, this is kind of a playback at the Steelers regarding a contract extension talk, which, to be honest, I don't think is even out of the question as we sit here right now. It gets a lot more interesting considering when you take Rudolph in the third round, a team doesn't have that 50-year option. So let's just say it works out like this. Ben plays 3 more years for the team. They win 2 Super Bowls. He retires after that third year. You've only got 1 year of Rudolph left. So with that, it puts the team in kind of a precarious spot, and it's coming from issuing sort of the ruffled feathers approach in that, you know, I want to play 3 more years, so you're only going to have 1 year of this guy anyway. So why did you draft him? Why don't you draft somebody that can play right now? To me, from the team's perspective, I really just think it wasn't as calculated as he kind of seems to want to think that it is. it's more they just got a valuable player in the third round, a player that they passed on in the first round and the second round, I might add. In the second round, for the second year in a row, they took another weapon for Ben, which was also something that he kind of seems to indicate didn't happen again. It's like they've stockpiled you with plenty of weapons, Ben. You're not going to need to worry about the offense. Go out and do your job. Play a lot better than you did over the first half of the season, and hopefully you guys have a better result in the playoffs.
Yeah, but isn't this the same guy who a year ago was toying with everybody about retiring? Now he wants to play 3 to 5 more years?
Yep, I don't think it's a coincidence either. It's just, you know, I think the situation fell the way that it did. He had probably a little bit more leverage on the team last year than he does right now, and it goes back to the contract talks. I think they've made him wait into the final year of his deal before, and I don't think he really liked that. This isn't an organization that typically does that. They want to have their quarterback signed for longer than just 1 year out if they don't have a backup plan in place. So I think more than anything, Ben is just kind of, you know, he hinted at the retirement idea when they knew that he's too expensive to get rid of. They couldn't possibly do anything without him. But next year, I'm not at all suggesting that this is the case. But next year, they have an actionable opportunity to cut him if they really wouldn't get hit that bad if they were to release him. Now, I don't think at all that that's happening, but I do think Ben is smart enough to know next season, for the sake of his security, he's going to want to have another year added to his contract if he doesn't want that right now. So I really think it's more posturing toward a contract negotiation than anything else.
All right, so now let's expand beyond this. When you look at their draft overall, they drafted needed safety in one. Then they got another safety that I think might be as good, if not even better, in Marcus Allen later on. And then, of course, they got Washington, Rudolph's buddy from Oklahoma State.
What really impressed me, and obviously the talk about Rudolph is merited because that's the newsworthy pick, but what a steal in Washington. I didn't think Washington would last that long. I mean, it's not the greatest receiver class in a first-round sense, but I thought a player like Washington, this is a kid that can step in and contribute right away. I mean, I'm definitely not going to predict a Juju Smith-Schuster like rookie year for him. But to be honest with you, this time last year, I remember talking about it. Smith-Schuster was all potential. He was so young, you weren't really sure what you were going to get, but you really liked what was already there. Washington is above that. So you're looking at a player that, at least, you know, on a recent model, and especially with more opportunity now that Martavis Bryant isn't there, that's somebody that can step in and make a pretty significant impact right away. And immediately you might have completely overhauled your three-receiver depth chart and come out better than you were before. To me, it was a masterstroke. I really was excited about the opportunity of a player like that coming into Pittsburgh because it's such a great fit. He really fits the mold of what they're trying to do with the position, which kind of needed to be changed over the last couple of years. They came out sparkling out of that. I two great picks 2 years in a row. People really should be excited about James Washington.
What about the safeties?
The safeties are intriguing. Now, what you get with Edmonds, he's probably not, well, he definitely isn't the player I don't think anybody expected to go in the first round, let alone to Pittsburgh, but he fits very much in the model of what they've been drafting in the first round ever since the Jarvis Jones disaster in 2013. They've wanted athletic, if not bigger size, than uniquely sized players for the positions that they're in, and guys that really can run around the field and hit guys. You know, you look at Bud Dupree, that's exactly who he is. Ryan Shazier was like that when he was playing. T.J. Watt was very much in that mold with, you know, less experience than any of the other guys had. Artie Burns didn't test all that much to really get a good sense of what his pure athleticism is, but he's a bigger cornerback. He's longer. He ran track at Miami. I don't think a slow person can really do that. Edmonds fits in very much with that. He's got some work to do, but I could see what they're really trying to do is bolster depth within their deep sub packages. It almost seems like they want to play dime most of the time. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, you would be able to do this better than I can, but that seems to be kind of a philosophy that Bradley might like. You know, you can put a lot of defensive backs on this and be athletic if they're big enough to support the run. And I think that's really what they're trying to do, is not get exploited in their sub packages, their mid range sub packages. Just even having five defensive backs on the field is different nowadays. I think they're trying to catch up with the versatility of today's offense and kind of the reformation of the running game with the run pass option. And I think getting the two safeties that they did not only replaces a lack of athleticism in their safety depth that they had last year, but it gives them an advantage from a strategic standpoint. It's going to be really hard to get them into a base package anymore. And with the athleticism they have from both of those safeties, you never know what they could do in 2 years. If Davis continues to develop as well, they could have a pretty legitimate secondary.
Yeah, as time went here, Tom went with more and more sub-packages. He would go with five, sometimes six defensive backs. So Tom did more and more of that when he was here before, obviously, he ended up leaving. I know you liked Darius Geis before this all went down. Was this Le'Veon Bell or bust here, the way it played out?
I think the running back that got in the fifth round, I don't think he's a Le'Veon Bell replacement. If anything, I think he's more of like their utility fullback / H-back. Yeah. He might get a carry or two here and there. I don't think he's a legit running back. And with that, Bell's contract comes off the books next year. I highly, highly doubt he'll be back after this season. I would be flat out amazed if he was. So I think they're trying to load up for this year, but at the same time, they can find an option somewhere in free agency. I know that completely negates the whole point of why they just paid him $26 million over 2 years. But overall, I think they can have a decent plan in place with what they have right now. They found it, you know, Stephen Ridley did a pretty decent job in the limited role that he had behind Bell last year. You're not 100% sold on where Connor is at this point in his career, but you've still got him on the cheap for three more years. He's going to be healthy coming to camp. Maybe he's somebody that they can count on as part of a run-by-committee approach, or maybe really the plan was to draft guys. Went one pick before him in the second round. I was really kind of hoping that he was going to be their guy. But, you know, I think options will present themselves, but they're focusing on right now in this year. And if running back is a position they need to address next year, that I think that's something they could do either and or free agency or the draft.
Right. So what's the next step? They've got camp, but OTA's coming up?
Yep. got OTAs coming up, and the story of that, of course, will be who shows up and who doesn't, and it's, you know, completely meaningless when it all comes down to it. I'll give you a spoiler alert here. Le'Veon Bell is not going to be at OTAs. Okay, let's just get that out in the open now.
You know, that's what the janitor said when I asked him last week.
He's smart. He knows. Why? Because, frankly, he would have signed his tender by now if he was going. You know, the mandatory mini camp is the only thing that he's required to attend. And with that, he would only be required if he had signed his franchise tag. And since he hasn't done that, I think it's pretty obvious that we're not expecting to see him until a day after camp breaks and a couple days before the fourth preseason game, just like last year. So other than that, yeah, you just kind of hope that the guys don't get hurt and the younger guys get an opportunity to show what they can do, and hopefully a couple of them can pan out and get on the field this year.
It'd be really fun watching Ben take Mason Rudolph under his wing at OTAs.
I could see the arm around the shoulder. You know, the memes that would come out of that would fill up the internet for days.
Days and days and days. Look at Ben. Look how much he's grown. All right.
The father figure. Everything's good. Everything's good, Rook. I got you back.
We're all good. Like Brett Favre looking at Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, remember when Steelers didn't draft Dan Marino because they had Terry Bradshaw? Don't worry, I'm not thinking about that at all.
No, not in the least. Got Mark Malone, though. All right. Neil, thanks. Appreciate it.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Neil Coulong, USA Today. Oh. You want me to tell you a Mark Malone story?
Sure.
Okay. About trying to learn from Bradshaw. Mark Malone really, really took his job seriously. I think Mark's been a good broadcaster because I think Mark is very prepared for everything he does. Well, that also went into football. So he wrote everything down. And so Jack is standing, and I got the story from Jack, obviously. And Jack is standing next to him on the sideline, and Mark Malone's charting. And he's charting everything, you know, five-step drop, three-step drop, seven, you know, look, you know. And he's trying to take notes more than just charting plays. He's trying to take notes. So Bradshaw goes back to pass, and he throws this ball downfield to Stallworth, and he throws into a triple. And Stallworth comes down, makes the catch, it's the touchdown. So Bradshaw goes running off the field, and Malone says, Brad, he says, all right, tell me, what'd you see? Why'd you go to Stallworth? And Bradshaw says, I looked up. He's the first guy I saw. Malone drops the clipboard and the pen, looks at Jack, and says, I can't learn this way. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. You know how you showed that putt that Craig holed on the 13th hole last week?
Right.
How come you didn't show the video on the fifth hole, the suit dancing to that song?
No, I I kept my phone in the golf cart for that. Didn't have it handy.
If everybody wants to know what actually led to the back spasms.
Oh, so it was one hole prior to the, okay. I could have sworn it was six, but you could be right.
Just telling you. Hey. I mean, even the chief, who, by the way, whose loyalty waned from about the fifth hole on. All right, I'm just telling you. The fifth hole on, I kind of felt like, okay, you know, I think he's actually seeing it the way we do. Just hit the ball, Kevin. Wow, the chief. Whoa. See, Craig's a little different. I wish he'd hit the ball. He'd say it under his breath. And then we'd have to hear it analyzed. Oh, I slid it off to the left or right. I just kind of moved my body. Right. Meanwhile, you're trying to tee it up like, okay, we got yours out of the way. We're good, okay?
We get the analysis anyway. It's part of the deal.
Quiet down. Others still have to hit. We made a good choice making the Chief the leadoff putter, though. He really did his job, man. He gave us good looks. I felt my shoulder just jerk a little bit.
Of course you did.
Yeah. Craig and I, at that point, were looking for a pond.
Oh, that's right. We're on the front nine. Oh,
no. The front nine is no pond.
No.
Okay. It's no way to escape. I think I even brought my scuba gear, too. It was right, it was right there in the bag. I was ready. It's like, okay, I've had enough. We're going. Hey, great to have you with us today. We'll talk about the NBA playoffs next. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. First time we've had him on, and I'm thrilled he's on with us. That's Keith Smith from RealGM.com and host of the NBA Front Office Show podcast. Keith, welcome. It's really great to have you with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Keith, we know that the Philadelphia 76ers have long lived in the world of analytics, which comes with it a wide variety of opinions, including lineups and so forth. What did it tell you about Brett Brown that he looked at a T.J. McConnell last night and he broke up the starting lineup and put McConnell in there because of past performance?
Yeah, I think it's that's the best kind of coaching. You know, when you're marrying the numbers with kind of the eye test and just the feel for what your team needs, I think Brett Brown knew his team needed a shot in the arm. They needed a guy who was going to come out and scrap and give them energy. And that's obviously what T.J. McConnell did, and he was a huge part of that. That win, I believe 19 points, I think it was, career high, playoff or regular season. But beyond that, it was just a lift in energy he gave the team beyond the scoring that really helped propel them to that victory.
Well, you look at game two, when I watched game two, I thought the Sixers, when McConnell was out there, were in pretty good shape. And then, look, he made the move back to Ben Simmons, and I understand that. He's your future. I've got it. So you got to show some confidence in him. But at that point, they went downhill. Was that really maybe a tipping point that maybe we ought to think about something different?
Yeah, you know, I think it's tough when you – I've always long believed if you put a point guard on the floor that can't shoot at all or in Ben Simmons' case, won't even attempt shots, you're going right. to – it makes that much more difficult on everybody to have to come up with bigger shots themselves. A guy like Simmons is so talented and can do a lot of things. But that puts all the pressure on everybody else to be a shot maker. And in this series, when you're going against a big man like Al Horford, who can really defend him and battle him inside as well as being able to drop off him and try to force him to be a shooter, that makes it really difficult on Simmons and then, by virtue, the entire Sixers offense.
Is Horford one a definition to you, Keith, of a real pro's pro?
Yeah, 100%. He's the kind of guy who I don't think numbers mean anything to him at this point in his career. Quite frankly, I don't know if they ever did. And I think he is just the kind of guy, he's going to go out there, give Brad Stevens whatever it is he needs. If he needs him to be a playmaker, he's going to do that. If he needs him to be a scorer, he's going to do that. And every single night, he's going to be probably one of, if not the best defender in the entire lineup.
What is it about Brad Stevens' between-game and in-game adjustments that impresses you or maybe doesn't impress you?
I think the thing that impresses me most is that he never asks his players to do anything they can't do. It's always about playing to their strengths, putting them in a position to succeed. He's not going to ask this Semi Ojeleye to go out there and try to be a 20-point-per-game scorer. He's not capable of doing that, so Stevens isn't even going to ask. The one thing I wish he would do on occasion, I think he lets the team try to play through things a little longer than he should, and he very much sticks to a pretty rigid substitution pattern, which at times makes it frustrating for fans, because you'll see a guy, you know, maybe hit 3-4 shots in a row, but if it's his time and minutes wise to go to the bench, he's going to the bench, and that can be a tough thing to swallow. In the long run, it's probably the best thing, but in game to game, it can be really hard to watch at times.
LeBron James and Cleveland. The other night, he hit that phenomenal shot going left, shooting right-handed, banking it in, winning the game. Now, situationally, I mean, let's be honest about it. I mean, you know, after broadcasting 36 years of basketball, that's a great situation for a team to be in, where the worst you get out of it happens to be overtime. Now, you may lose in overtime, but you're going to get no worse than overtime. How come people don't bring up that stuff when it comes to him? They weren't down one. I mean, he hit a shot in the game that was tied.
Yeah, you know, I think people, it's a little bit of let's build the legend up and let's build the mystique, that recency bias of, you know, he's the greatest ever, and let's just continue to add to that. But, you know, I think LeBron is the kind of guy who, if he can throw up a crazy shot and maybe win it or play for overtime, he's going to do that. I think had they been down one, he would have made a much more concerted effort to get himself as close to the basket or get fouled. He's just, you know, he's beyond being one of the most talented players, he's also one of the smartest players in the league, and he's not gonna risk things just for the sake of making it difficult on himself.
Yeah, and that's why, for example, to me, one of the elements that made Tiger Woods so special is that Tiger Woods was able to improvise on the fly as to what was needed at the time. I feel LeBron James does the same thing. Whatever I need to do at this time, if I need to try the spectacular, I'll try it because the situation warrants it, right? Like that one the other night. Or if I need something more conventional because you're down, he'll come up with something different.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that LeBron does now, too, especially as he's gotten older, we don't see him go to the basket for those kind of, you know, thunderous dunks anymore on a regular basis. But he'll pull those out when he knows his team needs one, or when the crowd needs it to get going. That's when he's going to pull those out. Or my favorite ones are when he does one on the road, when the crowd needs to be quieted down and he wants to send a message to them. Then that's when he's going to pull one of those out. And it's almost a, hey, don't forget, I'm still here and I can do this.
Well, speaking of still here, there aren't a lot of guys that are still there from January. I mean, when the trading deadline showed up, the Cavaliers made a lot of changes. They, you know, they kept Thompson, they kept Smith, they kept Kevin Love, of course. But they changed over a lot of that team. So, Keith, in reality, let's take LeBron off the floor. How good are the guys around him, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's maybe a 500 roster, and that might even be being generous. I don't know where you'd get the offensive creation from. Maybe Jordan Clarkson a little, but Jordan Clarkson was doing that for the last few years on a team that wasn't very good. Maybe Rodney Hood, but Rodney Hood's never healthy, and he's inconsistent when he is. So that, at best, is probably a 500 roster. The thing that I find most interesting is that LeBron, they made all these changes, but when the chips were on the table against the Pacers, he went back to his guys, the guys who have been there with him. And he said, I want to go down with my guys who have been through these battles with me and know what I know I can count on them. And that, other than George Hill, they really just went back to, all right, we're going back to the guys who have been with LeBron, and that's how we're going to win this thing. And that's what we've seen, or saw, rather, throughout the bulk of the Toronto series as well.
Everyone gets excited about the young stars in the league that get there. And Anthony Davis, justifiably so. I remember doing a game when he was at Kentucky against Penn State. Carl Anthony Towns, people like that. I mean, great, great young players in the league. Yet the teams that are advancing are, for the most part, older teams. Golden State's grown into being an older team. Houston's become one. Cleveland is one. What does that mean on this level to have been around the block? And what does it mean to have at least three players at a high level that have been around the block?
Yeah, it's certainly the veteran teams. The old adage is in the NBA is, very few teams win on their first playoff run. You got to get in there, take your lumps. I think guys are not used to the fact that everything comes faster and is that much more physical in the playoffs, and that every possession really does matter. You can't have turnovers, can't throw the ball away. Look at Philadelphia, you know, for example. They're so young. They played throughout a lot of this series with Boston kind of the way they played in the regular season. They didn't really value the ball. And against the team that executes like the Celtics, you're going to get buried when you do those kind of things. But, yeah, that's where it is. And then as far as having at least three players who have done it at a high level, that's been proven over and over again. It's the teams with the best and the most talent are generally the teams that are in there at the end. And all these teams that we're seeing now, they've either got a ton of talent or they've got really good high-end talent like a Cleveland that has a LeBron that really can't be matched by anybody else.
Keith, in your opinion, when you look at the sync and the synergy between Paul, Harden, and Ariza, what does that do for Houston in the hurdles that they're trying to clear?
Yeah, they're going to get this series wrapped up. I wouldn't be surprised if they wrap it up tonight against Utah. And then it's on to Golden State. And there's a path for them, obviously, to beat the Warriors. It's probably, I don't know how likely it is to walk that path, but it's there. And it's one where they hit, you know, a bunch of three-pointers in a couple games and win those games. James Harden wins the game almost by himself with 50 or so points, and then now you're in a game seven where anything can happen. But what it's done, in order for James Harden to have that game where he can score 50 and win it by himself, they needed to get him a guy like Chris Paul, who gives him what I like to call in-game rep, where James Harden, instead of having to be the ball handler on every single play, James Harden can give the ball to Chris Paul and say, you know, I'm going to go spot up for a couple of trips here because I need to catch my breath. Versus the last couple of years, he had to do everything offensively for the Rockets. He was completely worn down by the time we got to this point in the season.
Chris Paul is a great player, no question about it, the way he distributes the ball. Yet the odd thing happened in Utah the other night. He picked up his first fourth-quarter assist of the series, which that took me aback when I heard them say that. Are they doing too much one-on-one in the fourth quarter or just not threatened enough in the fourth quarter? Do you read anything into that at all?
I think there's a little bit to it, at least, where they default back to what they've been the last couple of years, which is get the ball to Harden and everybody get out of his way. And I think that's almost they occasionally need reminded of, hey, wait a minute, we have this other guy who's a Hall of Famer and an all-timer over there. Let's get him a couple touches and let him see what he can do versus always having to rely on James Harden. I think it's also a credit to the Utah defense. They have, in the course of each game in the series, they've really buckled down and been better each game as the game has gone on longer. But for the most part, I think it's more the Rockets just they're defaulting to what they know when there might be a bump in the road. And that's one of those things where that's on Mike D'Antoni to remind those guys, hey, let's make sure we keep Chris Paul involved.
Steph Curry is back, and now he's back in the starting lineup. How do you read Golden State right now? I'll just leave it open-ended. How do you read Golden State right now?
Yeah, I think they're the best team in the league, and I think they have shown at times in this series against New Orleans that they absolutely are the best team in the league, and that they, when they are really serious about it and they lock in, there's no team like them on either end of the floor. They can be the absolute best defensive team in the NBA as well as an offensive team that can't be touched by anybody else, and they've shown that at times. And I know a lot of people want to say, well, in the regular season they weren't that, and I think it came down to the bulk of that roster is they're bored. This is four straight years of this for them. They just need to get to the playoffs. You know, it doesn't matter. They just need to get there and get the real thing started. And we saw that in the first round. You know, they handled their business very easily without Steph. And then against New Orleans, they since he's been back, he's one of the easiest guys to reintegrate into a team because, you know, he can do so many things as far as an offensive player. So they just bring him right back in. They're rolling right now. And if you had to ask, I think they're going to be they should be the odds-on favorite, you know, to repeat as champions once again.
Every fan base in the country wishes they were that bored.
Right?
I mean, really. I have to ask you a college basketball-related question. The Rice Commission came out, and the first thing they talked about is something that they have no control over, zero, and that is the one-and-done. It's not an NCAA rule. This is negotiated between the Players Association and the NBA owners. Now, you and I both, we just talked about the NBA, the better teams are the older teams. I would ask an owner, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, they wouldn't mind having an older, more mature league. Meanwhile, the Players Association doesn't mind opening it up to anybody to get in there. Will the NBA address it? And if so, how long might it be before they address it? Because they don't have to do anything if they don't want to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They don't have to do anything until the next CBA comes up, and that's the next time the union can really push it. But I think one of the nice things with Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts have built a relationship where they say, we don't have to wait for things to get contentious before we start to address things, which is the best way it can be that's going to, you know, promote a healthy league. So I think you're going to see this get addressed in probably the next couple of years, and they're going to figure out something that they believe works. But the one thing that I continue to hear, and I want to be kind of conscious of it as always, the NBA is only ever going to do what is best for the NBA, and that includes the NBA Players Association. They, you know, for lack of a better term, they don't care about college basketball. They put them out of business as a entity, and it becomes, they have this giant, robust minor league, much like minor league baseball. I think they'd be perfectly content to have that. It's just they're not in position to do that. And those are the things that need to change. Is they've got to make some changes to the way the G League works, probably some of the salary and contract structure changes to make sure when you're bringing in these kids who are 17, 18 years old, you have something in place to take care of them. Because right now, I think what a lot of fans miss is most of your high-end college basketball programs, and that's not even the guys you're seeing on TV in the Final Four. I'm just talking the really good programs that are, you know, around the top 25. They have better facilities and development systems set up than the G League does. And it's just because the money has been pumped into those college programs to be there versus the G League. It's still, in a lot of ways, it's a fledgling, you know, thing, and it started. We don't even have 30 teams with their own minor league team yet. That's one of the things that I think is very easily forgotten by a lot of people when they say, change this, change that, and just be done with it.
Yeah, there are 30 NBA teams and 27 G League teams. Okay, the math tells you what the deal is. One final question, and I'm going to keep it on that angle. Is it important for people to understand, like, as you said, the NBA is looking out for the NBA, and that means the Players Association. Are really any scouts in the mood to go scout high school games again like they did 15 years ago? I mean, isn't it just easier to scout players that are in college?
Yeah, 100%. The answer is no. I talk to a lot of scouts. It's a big part of my job. And I can tell you, not a one of them wants to be back in high school gyms again. And what it means is every staff needs to increase probably close to 5 or 6 more guys. And then those guys have kind of their almost part-time unofficial guys who are out there being talent spotters. And it doesn't just mean getting into high school gyms. It means going to AAU tournaments.
It means having
these kids, you know, when they're sophomores and juniors, because you can't just go off their senior year. It's a big hassle that I don't think a lot of the scouts want. Unfortunately, I don't think they're going to get their way. I think that's where we're headed, is back to that direction, at least to some extent, where we're going to see these kids allowed to come back out of high school. It's going to be how they balance that. Maybe teams make rules of almost similar to the college game, where you can only see them at certain times of the year and only so many times, or things like that. I don't know where all that will go, because I know the scouts do not want to be in those high school and AAU tournaments on any sort of regular basis.
Absolutely not. And it's Keith Smith, RealGM.com, and the host of the NBA Front Office Show podcast. I really enjoyed this. Great information, great conversation. Thanks, Keith.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Keith Smith, once again, RealGM.com, and the host of the NBA Front Office Show podcast. We'll come back, wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. All right, Mark Ingram suspended 4 games. New Orleans Saints running back, violation of the PED policy. Alvin Kamara is sitting there saying, okay, give me the ball, I'm ready. Simple as that. But they announced the 4-game suspension today for Mark Ingram for the Saints, so he'll miss the first 4 games of the season. Playoff action tonight. We got the Yankees and Red Sox tonight. We will talk eventually. They're going to play games in London next year, and I already said this yesterday. You buy a season ticket package to the Yankees or the Red Sox. Now, obviously, you know, whether it's Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park, well, part of that is nine of those games are going to be against Boston if you're in New York, or nine of those games are going to be against New York if you're at Fenway Park. Hey, now you're going to move part of that to London?
They may have put that in the press release, but who's the home team? Who's going to lose a home game?
Oh, they probably lose one each. You know what I mean? I don't know. How many games are they playing there? I mean, I don't know how many games they're playing there. I would assume they're not just playing, to be frank with you, they're probably not just playing a two-game set. I doubt it. Oh, well. Utah-Houston tonight. Expect Houston to wrap it. It'll be the first time Chris Paul's ever been this far in the playoffs. Golden State and New Orleans play the late game tonight. Both games are on TNT.
Two games, Yankees-Red Sox, June 29th and 30th at London Stadium.
And probably losing one home game each. I'm sorry. You know, you pay your money. That's part of the package. I mean, take Tampa Bay. Move them over. Great. Tampa Bay. Move them. Okay. Major League Baseball tonight includes the Phillies, who thrashed. And I mean the Phillies thrashed the Giants last night. Wow. What, 11-0? They'll play again tonight, 6:30 the airtime here on News Radio 1070 WKOK and on WKOK.com. Phils and Giants this evening.
Yeah, Aaron Nola tonight, 4-1. Looking great so far.
Yeah, he's pitched really, really well. He gets the ball tonight against Derek Holland, who's 1-3. Nola is a 2.17 ERA. He has fewer hits than innings pitched. And he has a 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio. Meanwhile, Holland is 1-3 with a 5.70 ERA. Pirates play the White Sox tonight, first of a two-game set. Check out the Steve Jones Show podcast. Fun guest today. Josh Getzoff on the Pens, Keith Smith on the NBA, Neil Coulon.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.